Great to have everyone here tonight. It's special, special nights, warming up for the great and awesome day of the 10th day of Shvat. I see everybody saying 73 years. It's 73 years since the previous Rebbe passed away, but it's 72 years since the Lubavitcher Rebbe took the mantle of leadership, and 72 is awesome time. It's the highest name of Yud Kei Vav Kei. It's the Shem Hayim Beis. It's the ultimate infinite chesed. And so the energy of the light of Mashiach and of Geula and of godliness is in its full potency and its full power. So tonight we are super excited to have with us Rabbi Moshe Brisky. I don't know what he is to all of you, but to me, he's a dear, dear friend. And I'm excited to have him here, just that he's here. And if he says something, that is even going to be even better. But Baruch Hashem, it says, the Gemara says, Kahana Messiah Kahana, Kahana help Kahana out. He came here to help us at Mayan, help us prepare for this great, awesome day. And Rabbi Brisky doesn't need much introduction. We watch him on YouTube. We hear his classes, his talks. He's an inspiration to thousands of people across the world. And just a real good chassid.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been quite a few years, I think, since I was here last, Rabbi Wolf. It's been a few years. And since then, I've gotten a little grayer, a little heavier, and a lot older. There's actually this litmus test out there to determine whether or not you might be getting old. I have this litmus test to know that you ask yourself these questions. I took this test. I flunked. You may be getting old. It says when you bend down to tie your shoes and you try to think of what else you can take care of while you're down there. They say you may be getting old when everything hurts and what doesn't hurt doesn't work. You may be getting old when you get out of breath playing chess. How many of you are flunking this test along with me? You may be getting old when you sink your teeth into a steak and they stay there. Yes. Or they say you may be getting old when your blood type has been discontinued. So Yankel was on this platform at a train station and he notices a Jewish man standing nearby and he asks him for the time. And the fellow ignores him. So again, he says, excuse me, Rabbi Yid, what time is it? The fellow doesn't look at him, ignores him. He's getting frustrated. And he says it a little bit louder. Response. Is there a reason you're not responding to me? I'm just asking you a simple question. What time is it? And finally, the fellow turns to him and says, all right, look here. We're obviously two Jews. And what's going to happen is I'm going to tell you what time it is. And then you're going to start a conversation with me. And then the train's going to come. And of course, you're going to sit down next to me. And you're going to continue the conversation. And you seem like a nice guy. So you're probably going to just continue talking and talking. And at some point, you'll end up getting an invitation to my house for Shabbos dinner. Now, I have a daughter, a very sweet girl. And she's single. And you're going to see her. And you're going to probably ask her out on a date. Chances are the two of you will go out and you'll like each other. So why would I want to have a son-in-law that can't afford a watch? All right, let's talk about the subject tonight. We're getting ready for Yud Shvat, a historic day on the calendar. You know, if you are a history buff, you know that on any decade, you can write an entire book of histories to what took place in that decade. In high school, we used to pick a particular 50-year period to study what happened in the world during those 50 years. But the real historians always try to find that pivotal moment in time where a singular event takes place and everything that happens after that event has changed because of that one event. A pivotal moment in time where nothing is the same after it. It didn't have to take place over a decade, over a century, just a particular moment, a particular event, and everything thereafter is different and affected. In Judaism and Jewish history, we have those pivotal moments in time. I'll give you some simple examples. Hashem comes to Avram and says, Lech lecha, leave, go to the place that I will show you. And the world has never been the same again. One conversation, one instruction, it changed everything. A pivotal moment in time. All of Egypt eventually leads to the family coming down to Egypt, eventually leads to the Golos of Mitzrayim, eventually leads to the Exodus, it leads to the splitting of the sea, it leads to Har Sinai. One event, everything thereafter is affected. So you can look at various different stories of Torah, various different stories of Jewish history, and come to your own conclusions of what was those pivotal moments in time. I say with confidence that Yud Shvat is one of those key moments of Jewish history, not just regarding the 20th and 21st century, but for all of Jewish histories. Because it's on this day that these two giants that changed the Jewish world drastically are so connected. The Yahrzeit of the Friedeker Rebbe and the day that our Rebbe became Rebbe. This transition of the sixth Nasi and the seventh Nasi that have revolutionized the Jewish world. In the words of Rabbi Joseph Telushkin in his book Rebbe, he says the Rebbe brought about the greatest renaissance of Judaism in the history of the world. So we're not just talking about history of our lifetime. We're talking about of all of Jewish history, there has never been this renaissance that has taken place. And we can point to this day, that's that pivotal moment. Let me start by going back a few years. I want to go back to 1929. The Friedeker Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, at the time was living in Latvia after being exiled by Russia, by the Bolsheviks. He took a 10-month trip to the United States. Some 55 years after that trip, there was an article that appeared in the Jewish press. And this article talked about that 10-month period, that visit of the Friedeker Rebbe to this country. And in response to that story published in the Jewish press, there was a letter to the editor that was written to the Jewish press, someone responding. And he wrote, and I'll paraphrase just a little bit. He said that he had the privilege of meeting the Friedeker Rebbe during that trip. And to this day, he says, even in my old age, I think about the disrespect that I and my friends initially had for this great man. And even now, years later, when I think about it, I cringe. And he goes on to explain, there was a group of six of us. We were in our teens. We lived in Philadelphia. This was before the Depression, before World War II, and we were enjoying life. We abandoned Judaism. We belonged to some Jewish clubs, perhaps. We went to a Reform temple once in a while, perhaps for the high holidays. But we belonged to a Jewish youth group. That's what primarily was our Jewish connection. We considered ourselves progressive. We were enlightened. And one day, we read in the newspapers that this man, by the name of Rabbi Joseph Schneerson, known as the Lubavitcher Rebbe, came to the United States and actually planned on visiting Philadelphia. And that this rabbi thinks that he's going to come to the United States to inspire and to influence the Jews of America to adapt Jewish tradition. And the six of us, the group, we thought, what a chutzpah of this man. Who does he think he is to come to our country and to tell us what to do? Stay in Europe. Don't come here. Don't tell us what to do. We're enlightened. That's the ways of the past. This old-fashioned rabbi is going to come and talk to us when we are modernized people. That Sunday, when we got together with our youth leader, we discussed this and said, you know, we're really disturbed about this article in the newspaper. So the fellow says, I read the same article. And in fact, it says that on that, a week from this time, he's going to be visiting Philadelphia. It put the address on 33rd Street where he will be, and that it's open for people to come talk to him. Being that you're so infuriated by his visit, may I make a suggestion? Why don't the six of you go see him and tell him how you feel? Why are you telling me? You're upset at him? Go tell him. So we said, you know what? We'll do that. We'll give him a piece of our mind. And so we showed up a week later. This is his house, the address that was listed in the newspaper. We climbed the steps of the front porch, and we see through the window that the house is packed, crowded. We ring the doorbell, and this dignified man comes to the door, and he asks us what we want. And we said, we'd like to see Rabbi Schneerson. We came to see him. We have an important question for him. So the fellow took out his pad, and he said, okay, let me write down the question, and I'll bring it to him and let him know that there's a group waiting to see him. So they said, the question is, we really want to know what an old-fashioned religion has to say to a modern world, and why he thinks that he can come here from the old country to tell us in the new country what we should be doing. So the gabbai there says, as you can see, there's a long line of people ahead of you. Why don't you come in? You'll wait your turn, and I'll let you know when the Rebbe will see you. And we said, nah, we're just going to wait here on the porch. We're not mixing with those people. Okay, you want to wait on the porch? You can wait on the porch. And the six of us are waiting on the porch, and we're looking at each other. We're going to tell him. That's just a few minutes after this gabbai that was came to the door, comes back outside and says, the Rebbe would like to see you now. Now, we were beyond surprised that here we are now, we're ushered into the house. There's this waiting crowd thinking that we must be some important people, because after all, we just bumped the line and we're taken up the stairs. At the top of the stairs was this saintly rabbi. He had bright eyes, a very warm smile. He reached out his hand to shake our hands. He showed us into his room. There weren't six chairs there yet. There were four. But he himself went and found two other folding chairs, opened the chairs, and asked us to sit. We didn't think twice. We sat. And he says to us, I want you to know that since coming to the United States, this is the happiest time for me to be able to sit here with you. And you're probably wondering why I asked you to come up before everyone else that's downstairs that's been waiting for me for you. I said, I'll explain. Who are the people downstairs and what is it that they want? They all came here to get blessings. They all need blessings for different things, and legitimate things, important things. One's having a court case with someone, and he needs a blessing that he wins his court case. I'm not sure who's right and who's wrong. I'll give a blessing that justice should be done. One needs a blessing for health. I'll pray together with him to God that indeed health will come. One needs a blessing for parnasa, for business. I'll give them a blessing. With all of them, all I can do is join with them and pray together with them. But that's not why I came to this country. I came to this country to address your question. So when the Gabbai came in with his little notebook and said there's a group of six Philadelphia teenagers that want to know what a rabbi from the old shtet has to say to American Jewry, that's why I'm here. And that's why I ask that you come up right away. First of all, the Rebbe went on to say, you should know that there are 613 mitzvahs in the Torah. And while the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself tries his best, he finds it not always possible to keep all 613. Because some of the mitzvot are for Kohanim, and I'm not a Kohen. Some are for Levim, and I'm not a Levi. Some are for the kings, and I'm not a king. Some are only for the times when there was a Beis HaMikdash. And at this point, we're still in Golus. So as I go through the 613 mitzvot, as much as I want to do all of them, there are some that I simply can't. So what do? I do the best that I can. I look at the mitzvot that I can do, and I do the best that I can. As the Rebbe was talking to us, we start really, this man, there's such a warmth that's coming from him, such a love for us, and he never met us before. And all of these feelings that we had in our youth group and reading this article of anger, of who does he think he is, it was dissipating. It was all just going away. There was warmth. There was something real about him. There was something special about him. And we each felt it, just looking at each other as to what's happening here in this room. And the Rebbe says, and that's what I ask of American Jewry. Look into the Torah. Find your mitzvah. Find your way of connecting and do it the best that you can. And when you finish one mitzvah, you'll look for another and you'll look for another. But start somewhere. You can't do everything. It's too overwhelming for you. Start. Pick something. And each of you have a way of contributing to the greater Jewish whole. And then the Rebbe said, would you give me the honor of putting on tefillin with each of you? And now one of us could say no suddenly. All of us who were antagonistic, literally a half hour before, stood up, and it was such an honor for us. We were putting on tefillin with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And we each promised him before we left that we were going to follow his suggestion. And we're going to try to find something to change in our lives on account of this meeting. We walked through the crowd out the front door, and we stood on the front porch, and we stayed there for 2 hours looking at each other, comparing notes. Do you feel what I feel? Do you sense that there was something in that room, something magical, spiritual, mystical? Something happened to us in there. We were touched by a tzaddik. We knew it. We felt it. And each of us committed at that time that we were going to grow in our Judaism. This fellow is writing this letter 55 years later. And he writes, I want the audience that's reading this letter to know, every single one of the six, we all became observant Jews. One actually became a Chabad Chassid. The other five did not, but remained observant Jews. All of us married Jews. Our children married Jews. Our grandchildren married Jews. All from that one encounter. 11 years after the story, 1940, the Friedrich Rebbe came to the shores of this country to live the final 10 years of his life. When he first came to this country, 770 Eastern Parkway wasn't yet in the hands of Lubavitch. He stayed at a hotel in Manhattan called the Greystone Hotel. And between the torture and the persecution he suffered at the hands of the Russians and everything that his family had been through, he was physically a broken man, confined to a wheelchair, but spiritually he was this powerful force of energy. He was a determined man. And from the moment of his arrival, he began organizing yeshivas and shuls and mikvahs and publishing houses, building this infrastructure for Torah Judaism in the United States. So as he's at this Greystone Hotel, the Jewish leaders of this country, Federation leaders, American Jewish establishment leaders, came to meet the honored rabbi. They had appointments to see him. And one after another, they came to counsel the Rebbe. This is America. It's not Europe. You're here. You're safe. You have your small group of followers. Find a nice little home. You'll make a nice little shtibel. We'll get you some good doctors. And in America, what you do at this point in your life, you write your memoirs. You write a book. And you relax. Things are different here than in the old country. What you're trying to do here is not going to fly in this culture. It's not for this environment. American Jews don't want this. So just let it go. Just have your little shtibel. And the Rebbe put everyone on notice with the famous line, America's nicht anders, America's not going to be any different. It's going to happen here. That the torch of Yiddishkeit, of Jewish learning and of living, it was not extinguished by the Bolsheviks. It was not extinguished by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, and it will not be extinguished by an American culture of unawareness and assimilation. Make no mistake, the Rebbe said, we will carry the torch forward. And he defied the conventional wisdom. And of course, as you all know, those yeshivas were built, and those Torah centers were built, and the mikvahs were built, and the publishing houses did open. My father, Olav HaShalom, who escaped Hitler Yimach Shemai's clutches by seeking refuge first in Japan and then later in Shanghai, eventually finding freedom in this country, was an eyewitness to those 9 years of the 1940s. And they all remarked that they saw the strength and the resolve of the Friedrich Rebbe. Even back then, they knew something awesome was taking root. Now, for all of the pain and the sorrow that they endured, the phoenix would rise from the ashes. They didn't know how. They didn't know when. They didn't know where it would all unfold, but they knew that they were witnessing something miraculous. And that generation of Hasidim, who lost it all, lost their families, lost their communities, lost their shuls back in Poland and Germany and in Russia. These Hasidim came here and they followed the guidance of their Rebbe, who was their father. And they became our Malamdim, they became the Mashpiyim, they opened up schools, they went to Montreal to open the yeshiva, they went here to open the yeshiva. With all of their pain and all of their losses, they believed in tomorrow. When the Friedrich Rebbe, son-in-law, the Rebbe of our generation, assumed the leadership of Chabad on Yud Shvat, that torch began to shine with even greater radiance and intensity. And he began sending forth shluchim, emissaries, to all the far-flung corners of the earth, strengthening existing Jewish communities and creating new ones. In those early days, Chabad wasn't the household word that it is today. And Shlichus was a great challenge. It reminds me of the story, one of the longest told stories in the Torah is the story of Yosef. And the story begins by telling us that the brothers didn't like Yosef so much. He clearly knew that they didn't like him. And he had these dreams about them bowing to him. This didn't help matters much. And then Yaakov gives him a coat of many colors, and it really doesn't sit well with them. And one day, as the brothers are off taking care of their sheep in Shechem, Yaakov is concerned that they've been gone for a long time. And he says to his son Yosef, go and see how your brothers are doing. And Yosef doesn't hesitate, not for a second. Could it be dangerous for him to go find them? Certainly. Uncomfortable, beyond a doubt. But he's sent on a mission from Yaakov. So he doesn't procrastinate. And he arrives in Shechem and he doesn't find his brothers. And he meets a stranger in the street. And the stranger says, Ma mevakesh, what are you doing here? You look lost. You're not from here. You don't look like you belong here. What brings you to this city? And Yosef answers as Achai Anochi Mevakesh. I'm here looking for my brothers. My job is to bring them back to their father. The Lubavitcher Rebbe said to his Hasidim, and he says to each and every single one of us today, go find your brothers, go find your sisters. They may not be comfortable with you at first. They may not at first roll out the welcoming mat, but go seek them, to draw them, to bring them closer to their Father in heaven. You see, when the Lubavitcher Rebbe took over the leadership of the Jewish world was at its bleakest. We had just come through a Holocaust that decimated our people. 6 million. 1.5 million children. And those that survived had their faith challenged and questioned unlike any other time in our history. American Jewry found themselves accepted into circles never imagined before, and thus assimilation became rampant. Whereas in the earlier history, no one wanted to marry a Jew, in America, everyone wanted to marry a Jew. So intermarriage and apathy were biting at the heels. At that time, when the Rebbe became leader, there was this Harvard University study that came out. And it predicted that based on the demographic trends, the American Jewish community would likely number less than 1 million by the time the United States would reach its tricentennial in 2076. And that's what the graphs were showing them. By their findings, they predicted that it won't be long before American Jewish life would be a shadow of its vibrant self, consisting primarily of some isolated pockets of ultra-Orthodox Hasidim. And they conclude the report that they use the word Kaddish time, knowing of our prayer of Kaddish. It's time to say Kaddish for American Jewish community. So many innocent Jews schlepped away from their roots, from their heritage, from their Torah, not by the tyranny of oppression as in the past, but by the magnetic draw of assimilation in the land of the free. You see, this newfound freedom led to a desire to be free from it all. So many dropped religious life, stopped practicing the ways of their parents and their grandparents, said goodbye to Shabbos and goodbye to kosher and goodbye to synagogue life. And then new movements popped up offering this diet version of the Judaism light, where you don't have to do all of these mitzvot. In the place of mitzvot and traditions, they made clubs and memberships and tea parties. And an innocent generation of Jewish children grew up in the United States denied of their Jewish heritage, denied of even the memories of having parents or grandparents that practiced with Jewish traditions. Denied the memories of a Kiddush or a Pesach Seder. Denied the memories of what it's like to live in a Jewish home. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon if you think about it. When you get a bouquet of flowers, you put it in the vase, you put it on the table, it looks very nice. You have guests over for Shabbos, the table looks beautiful because it has flowers. They don't really last too long. By Tuesday, starting to wilt a little bit. By Wednesday, you're debating, do you throw it out? Does it look better if we don't have them at all? Because once the flower is cut off from its root, it only has a certain amount of days left. Now, you could buy the Bubba Meister by putting those aspirins in the water there that comes with those little powder things. It gives it an extra 2 hours, maybe. So the cut flowers, they don't really last that long. Why? Because they're cut off. When you cut it from your roots, it's only a matter of time. But even if the flower, certain amount of life that it has. Now, particular flowers last longer in proper climates. But if you take a flower that's nature is to grow in California, Hawaii, and you plant it in Brooklyn, it also won't last that long, even when it's connected to the ground. Why am I boring you with my flower story? Judaism in America looked like it was going down the path of the cut flower phenomenon. It wasn't connected to roots anymore. It was cut off from its past. It had no traditions to hold dear and sacred. At most, it was a few days a year. And then on top of that, you had cults, some Maharishis and missionaries preying on Jewish souls. Intermarriage reached a high of over 50%. Historians and statisticians will tell you that in order for any ethnic group to survive, you need a minimal birth rate of 2.1 per family. The American Jewish family is at 1.4. So statistically, we were disappearing. What the statisticians of the Harvard study knew, and knew correctly, was that without the pressure of the shtetl life, without anti-Semitism that forced the Jews to stick together, without the authority of the rabbi being the central authority of the community, without Jewish practice and traditions being part of day-to-day life, Judaism and America didn't stand a chance. We were a bunch of cut flowers, just waiting to wilt away. And if we at best sprinkled a tradition here and a latke there and a piece of gefilte fish there, and we went to see Fiddler on the Roof, these roots were like planting seeds in an unnatural environment, and we were bound to fail. And yet, none of these doomsday predictions took place. Remember, I opened with Joseph Talushkin's line, "We are experiencing and witnessing the greatest renaissance of Judaism in the history of the world." How did this happen? Back in 1972, the Rebbe was approaching his 70th birthday. And there were some well-meaning disciples who suggested to the Rebbe that now that he was reaching the age of 70, perhaps he should slow down a bit, cut some of his hours, work a little bit less, a vacation here and there would be nice. They should have known better. To offer the Rebbe semi-retirement meant you didn't know the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And those of you that are here remember perhaps the months leading up to Shnas HaShivim, that 70th year. And at one of the Farbrengens leading up to it, the Rebbe said he's had many requests asking him what he would like for a birthday gift. Being that it's a tradition here in the United States to get a present on your birthday, and his big birthday was coming up, he was going to publicize what he would like for his birthday. And he said, "For my 70th birthday, I would like 70 new institutions." Now, today the number 70 may not be that shocking because Rabbi Kunin can open 70 in a month. But back then, that was literally doubling the amount of Chabad houses in the country in a matter of a few months. So what had taken 20, 30 years, the Rebbe was asking in a few months. I remember, even though I was a little child, being at that Farbrengen on the Rebbe's 70th birthday. 770 was packed to capacity, felt spirit in the air. It was a very special Farbrengen. And of course, you, as you all know, that list was brought to the Lubavitcher Rebbe of all the new institutions, which was far more than 70, many of them in California here itself. Chabad of Encino, Chabad of the Valley was one of those of the 70 that was given to the Rebbe as a gift. And there were delegations coming up to the Rebbe from different cities, giving the Rebbe a key, gold key, to the Chabad house that they're opening in honor of his birthday. So that was the birthday gifts he was getting, was plaques with keys. And there was this one delegation that came from California, which the Rebbe said, "If you're giving me the key, that means that I am a part owner. If I'm a part owner, I'd like to ask that the Chabad house remain open 24 hours a day, and that the key is never needed because the door will never be closed." There was another group that the Rebbe said, "Now what you're witnessing to hear today, and the opening of 70 new institutions, is going to become in style." The Rebbe predicted this in 1972. "And that the day will come that Chabad is going to be like a chain store. And just like you have Macy's and A&S and Corvettes," those are some of the stores back then, "that have their department stores in every single city in the country, the day will come that Chabad will be like that as well." And this delegation smiled. cute hyperbole exaggeration. Yeah, the day will come, the Chabad's going to be like, Macy, yeah, Rebbe, it should be that way. I'm Maine, you know, say l'chaim, take a picture, you're good. In the decades that followed, the Rebbe would continue to launch initiative after initiative, campaign after campaign, project after project, mitzvah after mitzvah. Carry the torch forward. Never satisfied. Pleased, but never satisfied. Always wanting more. Educate more children. Reach out to more families. Touch more lives, wherever they may be, whoever they may be. That prediction on the Rebbe's 70th birthday changed stories. So before coming here today, I looked up on Google, how many Macy's are there in the world? There are today 722 Macy's in the entire world. It once reached 900 and COVID shut down quite a few. 722. How many Chabad houses are there in the world? It's close to 5,000. I need you to think about this. 1972, a Rebbe saying the day will come that it will be like department stores and that every city will have one. It was looked at as hyperbole. It was dreamlike stuff. But to the Rebbe, it was a mission. It's going to happen. This was planted here in 1929. This was planted in 1940. This was planted in 1950. There was a mission. There was a plan. There was a strategy. We're going to do this. Not only the United States. We're going to take over the world with Yiddishkeit. There's been a lot of talk you hear about going global. Today's world is a global world, global communication, global economy, global politics, that what happens in one place affects the other place. It's no longer just separate countries. It's really all global. And for us Chabadniks, this word global is not new. We've been going global for over 70 years. What's the theme song of Chabad? It's Uferatzta Yama Vakema Tzafona Venegma. It was everything the Rebbe taught us is take on the entire world. Don't think small. That became the Rebbe's rallying cry. The Rebbe called on his Hasidim to share his vision for a bright future for all of the Jewish people. And he challenged us and he looked us in the eye and he said, you can make a difference. You can impact the community. You can change a world. Yes, you. Teenagers, kids, go on with time on Friday after school. He took children and he made them into leaders overnight. Remember the respect and the honor that the Rebbe gave the tankist. Remember, by every Farbrengen, he would ask for all those that went on with time to come up to him and he would give them dollars to distribute to others. You felt like a million bucks. You were standing in line to the Rebbe. You are important. You were a tankist. You are part of his army. And that he created within us this belief that you as a teenager can actually make a difference in the Jewish world. So first tens, and then hundreds, and then thousands of emissaries went forth upon every continent, making it to what it is today, the largest Jewish organization in the history of the world. How did he do it? How is this accomplished? I'd like to focus tonight on just one of the approaches. Perhaps the best way of expressing myself is in stories, telling individual stories to paint the picture of how the Rebbe changed the Jewish world. The story is told about one of the great shluchim of the previous generation, Rabbi Chaim HaKohen Gutnik, Alav HaShalom. Rabbi Gutnik was a very prominent and prestigious rabbi in Australia. He was president of the Rabbinical Council of Victoria. He was chaplain of the Australian Defense Forces. He was a very dynamic and eloquent speaker. When he would speak, he would create this vivid, breathtaking color, and he would enamorate his audiences, moving his audiences to tears. The story goes that in one Yechidus, when he came to New York to see the Rebbe asked him about what are you doing about the mitzvah of Taras HaMashpacha in Australia, of mikvah. How are you promoting it? Now, back then, mikvah was something talked about in private. Rebbetzin would talk to a woman before she was getting married, but it was never then. It wasn't one of the mitzvah campaigns early on. It wasn't something that was a public lecture series. So he didn't have much to answer. So the Rebbe told him it would be kedai if when you got back to Australia, you organized a lecture on the subject of Jewish family purity. You're a speaker, you're a lecturer. Make that your subject. Now, if the Rebbe's asking you to do something, it's yes, sir. But in the back of his mind, he's thinking, it's not one that I can sell. How am I going to do this? But okay. Now, if the Rebbe asks you to do it, you're going to try to do it right. So you're going to design a nice flyer. However, flyers were designed back in the 1960s. You're going to put an ad in the newspaper. You're going to rent a ballroom somewhere. You're going to do it right. The Rebbe asked you to promote a lecture. What wouldn't you do? So whatever he can do back then, he did to promote this talk. And then, of course, he worked for hours and hours and hours, finding the best, most eloquent words that he can explain the importance of mikveh, the importance of keeping the laws of mikveh. So picture this. Countdown begins, 7 days to his big lecture, 6 days. And the Rebbe also asked him that I want you to send me a report after the lecture, how it went. So now you're really nervous. A homework assignment like that comes to the day of the lecture. And he comes to the ballroom. And he has at that moment what we in the rabbinic world will call our worst nightmare. Let me tell you what our worst nightmare is. If I came here tonight and no one was in the room, that's not my worst nightmare. Because no one will know that no one was here. So I'll have some cookies, I'll have some tea, I'll go home. It's Kabbalah. But if I came here and there was only one person, now I have to stand up here at a podium and talk to one person. It's not easy to do. And then everyone in the community is going to know that one person showed up. And that's what he faced. This large room, he thought it was going to be full to capacity. There's one woman sitting in the front row. Gets up and he gives his lecture. He comes home and he's in tears because he has to write a report to the Lubavitcher Rebbe about how it went. And he writes an apology letter. I'm sorry I let you down. I tried, publicized it, I worked hard on it, but I let you down. I'm sorry. I gave the speech, but there was only one woman there. The Rebbe sends him a one-line response. And the one-line response is, Moshe Rabbeinu had only one mother. That was the response. Moshe Rabbeinu had one mother. It took one woman to change the entire world. The whole world is not the same because there was one woman named Yocheved. And she gave birth to a Moshe, who took 2 million Jews out of Mitzrayim, who brought 2 million Jews to Sinai, who from that point have been a light unto the nations and changed the history of every single human being on the face of the earth. It started with one woman. So stop your nonsense of apologizing to me. You had one woman there, you changed the world. The world is not the same. It says in the Talmud, the Fichach Nivra of Adam Yechidi, the reason that God created the human being singularly, individually, whereas others he created an entire species, but the human being was created alone, was to teach us that one person equals the world. That if you affect positively one person, you have changed the entire world. Moshe Rabbeinu had one mother, one woman, and the whole world is different. The one woman who showed up for Rabbi Gutnick's lecture. Who is she? I don't know. What happened after that lecture? I don't know. Did she become perhaps the matriarch of a large family? I don't know. Is her daughter or granddaughter or great-granddaughter somewhere some great Rebbetzin of some community inspiring tens of thousands? I also don't know. But to the Rebbe it was, if you did a mitzvah, if you inspired, if you taught one Jew anywhere on the face of the earth, you've changed the entire world. Existence is not the same anymore. That's the way the Rebbe looked at each and every single Jew. We're taught that if one Jew was missing at Sinai, then the Torah would not have been given. And if one Jew today, whether they live in Los Angeles or Milwaukee or Kentucky or Japan or the Netherlands, is missing from the family of the Jewish people, then we all have a void. There's something missing within us all because we're missing one member of the entire family. As Isaiah says, he prophesies concerning the era of Mashiach, the atem to look to echad echad. You want Mashiach to come? You have to gather the Jewish people. He said, echad, echad, one by one by one. But for the Rebbe, this wasn't poetic. It wasn't a handy catchphrase. He meant it. It was a very real philosophy and a very practical implications of this philosophy. Find one Jew and you'll change the world. One mitzvah at a time. One yid at a time. And that's what the Rebbe taught all of his Hasidim. It's not a generation you can afford to look inward. It's not a time to build your protective walls around your shtetl and ignore what's going on outside the walls of your shtetl. It's not a time to close your eyes to the spiritual needs and the thirst of millions of your brothers and your sisters. Es achai anoichi mevakesh. Go out to whatever city you can. And look for your brothers and look for your sisters. The Rebbe was a revolutionary figure. He wouldn't accept the status quo. The Jewish people in the Jewish world needed love. The Jewish people in the Jewish world needed inspiration. The Jewish people in the Jewish world needed a welcoming embrace. The Jewish people in the Jewish world needed each and every one of us to take our candle and to kindle someone else's flame with it. In New York, and they have it in many places as well, there's something called the Release Time Program. Release Time Program in New York was Wednesday. What did that mean? The public school system allowed for people of faith, for people of different religions, for their parents to choose that they can have 1 hour of school off a week for religious training during school time. Of course, there were issues of separation, church and state, so it couldn't be sponsored by the school. So if there was a church or a synagogue that wanted to come in and take, in our case, Jewish children out of the school for 1 hour, the school had to abide by it. And of course, the Rebbe took full advantage of this release time program to encourage his rabbinic students and his bachrim to go to public schools and to get any Jewish child whose parents would sign this waiver to take advantage of this 1 hour a week where they would be able to learn something. Now, what could you do in a week, in an hour? You can say Shema Yisrael with them. You can say Torah Tziva with them. You can make a bracha with them. You can tell them a story, and then they're back to school. And the leader of this program, J.J. Heftal of Hashalom, put his whole life into this, encouraging many Lubavitcher students in 770 to devote this time on Wednesday to be assigned to a particular public school. And hundreds of thousands of Jewish children, that was their only connection to Yiddishkeit. So I saw this on Living Torah. My cousins was the one that told the story during his time in 770. He says there was a friend of his that at first signed up for the program. And then he wrote a letter to the Rebbe. And the letter that he wrote was as follows. I originally signed up for the program, but I want out. I want to get your permission to bow out. Why? For starters, I love learning. I love sitting by a Gemara and studying. And it's not an hour of time that I'm losing, because I was given a school that's an hour away from Crown Heights, which means it's an hour there, it's an hour with the kids, and it's an hour for the subway back. That's 3 hours. Plus, I have to prepare something for this. So it's another hour. So I'm really losing 4 hours of study that I could really be immersed in Star Wars. 4 hours a week is a lot. That's number one. Number two, I'm not good at it. I don't have that social skill. I don't think I'm inspiring these kids for anything. There are Bachrim that are a lot better than me that will take my place. But because this is something that I know is dear to you, I'm not going to do it unless you give me the okay to bow out, and you'll get someone else to take my school. Now, you can say the Rebbe would be proud. Here's a yeshiva student saying, I miss learning. I want to learn those extra 4 hours. Of course, we can find someone else. The response from the Lubavitch Rebbe, understand the words of what the Rebbe says to this bachur, because you'll begin to understand the philosophy in which he managed to change an entire Jewish world. He said, I want you to know what takes place in the heavenly world during that hour that you're with those kids in the public school. In the heavenly world, there's this whole commotion. And all the Tanoim and Amoraim from the Talmud, the characters from the Talmud that you want to sit in front of and study during this time, they stop what they're doing up above to look down. And they want to know who has the merit, the schus, to say a pasuk Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad with these precious children. Who has that honor? We're so jealous of him. We wish we had that opportunity. Even so far, says the Rebbe, that Moshe Rabbeinu, in the loftiest place in the heavenly world, stops what he's doing, and he looks down and he hears innocent children raised in America saying, Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe Marasha Kehilas Yaakov. He hears his name in this verse being said by these children. And he says, who has that merit to be able to leading these children in saying this? So you still want to quit? That's the way the Rebbe looked at each and every single Jewish child, at every pasuk said by a Jewish child, at every mitzvah said by a Jewish child. That's what the Rebbe believed. That's what he knew. And that's what he inspired his followers to devote their lives to. A number of years ago, I was speaking at the JLI retreat in Virginia. It's a summer retreat. And if you've ever been to a JLI retreat, it's a whole panel of speakers. They bring in the first few years, it was 20 speakers, then it grew to 40 speakers. Now it's about 100 speakers as the crowd got bigger and bigger. And so that particular year, one of my co-speakers that were there at this retreat was a wonderful educator from Crown Heights, Miriam Swordlove. Some of you may have taken classes from her, seen her online. She's a wonderful educator, brilliant woman, great sense of humor as well. And she was giving lectures, I was giving lectures, but there was a time where I was off and she was on. So I was able to attend her talk. Now, I do want to tell you that at the moment I came in and I sat down in the back, Miriam stopped her talk and said, Moshe, if you steal my story, I'm going to get you. So I'm stealing her story. And Miriam, if you're watching this ever, I'm sorry. And in her talk, which was dynamic, it was a wonderful talk, she challenged her audience with this question. Here's the question. I'll paint it for you as Miriam did for her audience. Suppose you have your teenager about to leave home and go off to college, and you're concerned about her remaining connected to Jewish life and Judaism. You have your concerns. You weren't raised in an observant home, but at the same time, Judaism is important to you. And so you want to say something to your kid before they leave home to just make sure they keep a connection. And suppose you've done all your speeches and whatever, it had an effect or didn't have an effect, you don't know. And now you can give your teenage child one book, just one book, to satisfy this thirst that you have to keep your child connected to Yiddishkeit. What's the one book you give? And everyone in the room, she said, must answer the question. There's no right answer. There's no wrong answer. I want to hear your answers. What book do you give your child, your teenager? I won't go around the room challenging you with that question, but you can imagine what some of the answers in this room was. I'd give her a prayer book. I would give him a Chumash. I would give him, you know, those that were more from a Chabad line, perhaps, would say a Tanya. Those that were more secular would book a book by Elie Wiesel, a book by Herman Wouk. Everyone was coming up because everyone had to answer the question. And she went around the entire room. I'm thinking, where is she going with this? And then she says, after everyone gives their answer, she says, now I'll give you my answer. Okay, she's got my attention now. And she picks up what looked like a pamphlet. I'm trying to figure out, what is she holding in her hand? And it was a paper staple pamphlet that listed every Chabad house in the world. Just name of the rabbi, of the Rebbetzin, and the address. And she said, this is the most important book for you to give your child. Why? Because this sends a message that we've never been able to send to our children in the history of the world. I want you to know, my dear son, my dear daughter, wherever you go in the world, you're not far from your home. You have a home near you, and the rabbi and the Rebbetzin there will be your father, will be your mother, will care for you no matter who you are or what you need. She said, do you understand that never in the history of the world were we able to say that to a child? That wherever you go in the world, you have a home? It's never been that way. This is the first time that any place that a member of your family may find themselves, there is a home. We've never had that before. It's never been. A colleague, Rabbi Avram Berkowitz, he was a bacher. He was sent to Alaska, what we call Merkez Shlichus. You're familiar with Merkez Shlichus during the summers. They go to various different far outpost cities where you don't necessarily have a Chabad house because there's not too many Jews. And you try to find on the outskirts of the world fellow Jews that are in need, perhaps to get a book, a mezuzah, put on film, a Shabbos candle. And he was sent to this place in Alaska. And he came to this small city in the northwest part of the state. And small little talent. He meets the mayor and he tells the mayor he's here to see, to visit the Jews of the city. And the mayor says, there ain't no Jews in this city. But, you know, we do have a local school, Eskimo populated students, and I'm sure they would love to see you. They'd love to hear about you, some what Judaism is about. So he takes up the invitation with the mayor to go talk to the kids. And he's sharing some of what he's doing and teachings about Judaism. And they start doing some Eskimo dances. He starts doing a Hasidic dance. They're having a wonderful time together. And then he asks the students, have any of you, by any chance, ever met a Jew? And one girl raised her hand and said, I have my mother. And she's right there. It was a fifth grade teacher. And she's being pointed out by her daughter that she's Jewish. So after the class, Rabbi Berkowitz, of course, makes his way to the fifth grade teacher. And she's visibly very moved. Thanks, Rabbi Berkowitz, for coming. And she explains that growing up, she always loved nature. And so years earlier, she came to Alaska and she fell in love with the area. She also fell in love with a native man. And it's been beautiful. But living here, she tells Rabbi Berkowitz, I don't think my daughter will ever get a chance to meet another Jew again. just doesn't come around here too often. Definitely not another rabbi. So while you're here, can you say something to her meaningful about Judaism? Imagine putting you on the spot. Fill in for everything I didn't do. And I was standing on what's like the story of Hillel, but multiplied by 10. And teach her everything you need to know. So Rabbi Berkowitz has to think fast. And he says to the girl, the holiest day of the week for the Jewish people is Shabbat. Gives a very brief explanation of what Shabbat means. And who ushers in Shabbat? The mothers and the daughters of the Jewish people. They usher in the holiest time of the week. How? They light a candle. And when they light a candle, they bring spirituality. And do you know, he asks the girl, where the sun sets first? The girl knew her geography, said probably New Zealand or Australia. That's right. So the Jewish mothers and daughters in New Zealand and Australia are the first in the world to usher in Shabbat. Then Shabbat is ushered in Asia, then in Israel, then in Europe, then in New York, then in Chicago, then in Seattle. Then it makes its way to Anchorage, Alaska. And even then, there's still one part of the world where the sun still did not set. That's right here in the Yupik territory of Alaska. So when mothers and daughters all around the world have welcomed the Shabbat, God is still waiting for one girl that lives right here to kindle the Shabbat candles. And then the whole world is blessed with that spirit of holiness of Shabbat. God waits for you and your mom to light the Shabbat candle every Friday. The girl and her mom were blown away. They promised to begin lighting the Shabbat candles every Friday night from there, that point on. And they promised they can't let down God. If God's waiting for them, they have to be there with their candle. That's what the Rebbe taught us. How do you change an entire world? How do you bring about a great renaissance? How do you bring about a revolution? One at a time. One candle in Alaska at a time. One tefillin somewhere at a time. One mitzvah at a time. There is this parable that came from, I believe it was from the Dubna Magid, but we'll modernize it just a bit. It was this fellow, this businessman. He's quite successful in life, in the world of wholesale and retail. But he had a son that didn't do well in school, to the point that the son stopped going to school and the son stayed home all day, doing nothing with himself. The father says to the son, "Son, you're not going to go to school. At least be involved in the business, learn a trade." The kid says, "Okay, teach me a trade." He says, "Okay, want to learn? This is how you do it. There's a concept called wholesale. Wholesale means you buy an item in bulk. If you buy it in bulk, they'll sell it to you at a cheap price. Why? Because they're getting rid of a lot of merchandise in one with one customer. Then you take that merchandise and you sell it with what's called retail. Retail means you're selling it one at a time. When you sell it one at a time, you charge more. And the difference is your profit. What do you do with the money after you sell it? Now you go back to the wholesalers and you buy more product and you keep doing this and you become a wealthy man like your dad. Wow, it's that easy. Yeah, and I'll start you off, my son. Here's a sack of gold coins. I want you to go to the wholesale marketplace. It's two cities away. And over there, they sell things in bulk. You'll buy it in bulk, bring it back here. You'll set up a shop here. You'll sell it retail. You'll make a profit. You'll go back. At least you'll do something with your life." Kid's all happy. "This is great, Dad. I can do this. I can do this. Thank you for trusting me." Gives him the sack of gold coins. Kid goes two cities away, goes to the wholesale marketplace. He's standing there with a sack of coins like this. Well, there's some hungry business people there that see this kid there, and they know they could take advantage of him. "Son, would you like to buy something wholesale?" "Oh, yeah. I got a sack of gold coins. Tell me what I can get. Come with me. to our warehouse they go. And in the warehouse, there's 10 wagon loads filled with merchandise. I'm going to give you these 10 wagons filled with merchandise for one small little sack of gold coins. Wow. That's going to be so proud. By the way, what's in the wagons? The wagons are filled with millions and millions of toothpicks. Toothpicks. Can you imagine millions of toothpicks for one sack of gold coins? That's great. Dad's going to be so proud. Gives over the sack of gold coins, comes parading home with 10 wagon loads. Father comes out. What did you get, son? Dad, I did exactly what you said. This was so easy. What'd you get? Millions and millions of toothpicks. Toothpicks? Are you crazy? You have more toothpicks than this town has teeth. What are we getting? How are you going to sell millions of toothpicks? All the wagons have the same thing, all toothpicks. You idiot, you. I thought you were smart. He embarrasses his son. His son is embarrassed, insulted, runs to his room. He's crying away. The father sits and thinks, you know, I didn't handle that well. It wasn't his fault. I really never told him that he's got to check out the product. All I told him was to buy something wholesale. I didn't give him a lesson. I didn't teach him. Calls his son out, says, son, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry that I yelled at you. I'm sorry that I insulted you. I'm really sorry that I didn't teach you really the art of business. Because aside from buying something wholesale and selling it retail, there's something else called marketing. Marketing means you have to think about how you're going to sell the product. Can it be something that can be sold? You got to think before you buy it. Dad, I won't let you down. Here's another sack of gold coins. He's back to the marketplace. This time he's not holding the sack out there. He's holding it under his jacket. Hungry businessman comes. Son, would you like to buy something wholesale? Not so fast. Depends what it is. See, he's learned his lesson. Come with me to the warehouse. They go. Wagons, 10 wagons. Ah, but what's in the wagons? These are 10 wagons filled with shofars. Shofars. It happens to be a month before Rosh Hashanah. Perfect timing. Can't you see the ad right now? Do you have your shofar yet? Perfect. Dad's going to be so proud. Gives over the sack of gold coins, comes parading home with 10 wagons. The father comes out. What'd you get? Dad, you're going to be proud. I did what you said. I asked this time, marketing. How can I sell it? What'd you get? 10 wagons filled with shofars. Shofars. The town has one shul. The one shul has 10 chauffeurs. People don't need their own chauffeur. They go to shul, they'll hear the chauffeur. Why are we going to sell this? You idiot, you. Yells at this kid again. This poor kid runs to his room crying again. A week goes by. The father's got a problem. Not the son. He's too expensive. But he's got another problem. You see, he has a beautiful house. But the driveway on the right of his house is blocked with 10 wagons full of toothpicks. And the driveway on the left of his house is blocked with 10 wagons full of chauffeurs. And he's got to get rid of the stuff. It's just blocking his driveway. And so he calls up a professional tradesman. And he says to this professional tradesman, I got 10 wagon loads filled with toothpicks. I want you to barter it, trade it for anything you can get for it. Just get it off my property. He comes and he takes 10 wagon loads full of toothpicks, sends him on his way. At least I got the right driveway clear. He calls another professional tradesman. I got 10 wagon loads full of chauffeurs. Barter it, trade it for anything you can. Just get it off my property. It's gone. At least all the wagons are gone. A few days go by. He's sitting on the front porch on the rocking chair. He's having his cup of iced tea. And he sees a cloud of dust from the right and a cloud of dust from the left. And as these clouds get closer and closer, he bursts out in laughter. He starts rolling on the floor in laughter. He can't control the laughter because he realizes that the tradesman with the toothpicks met the tradesman with the chauffeurs and they swapped. And each one is now coming back to his house with the other guy's junk. And he's got 20 wagon loads blocking his driveways all over again. And he can't stop laughing. It's the funniest thing he's ever seen. Now the son, who's still hiding in his room, here's the laughter. So he comes out of the room. What's so funny, Dad? He sees his father rolling on the porch of laughter. What's so funny? You can never believe it. Remember the garbage you brought back from the marketplace? Yeah, I remember. The 10 wagons of the stupid professional tradesmen, 10 wagons of shovels, and then they send them on the way, wagon went away, and now they're coming back. He's trying to explain to his kid what happened here. His kid's got a straight face, no smile, no laughter. Don't you understand what happened? Don't you see what's funny? No, Dad. It's not funny at all. In fact, I'm very upset right now. You see, when you called me and you told me, this naive kid, to go to the wholesale and come back with something, and yeah, I messed up. I didn't get what you thought was good. But what'd you do? You insulted me. You yelled at me. You didn't laugh. Now you brought professionals. These guys have been doing it for years. They came back with the same junk I came with. Now you're laughing? Now it's funny? How come it wasn't funny when I came back? The father says to his son, first, I apologize for how I yelled at you and insulted you. I should never have done it. But don't compare the two. Because them I sent out with junk, and they came back with junk. But you I sent with gold. And when you're sent out with gold, you got to come back with gold. You got to invest that gold and come back with something meaningful. Each and every single one of us that's connected to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, we were sent out with gold. We have to invest that gold. We have to utilize that gold, utilize this privilege, the honor that has been given to us, and do something with it. You know, in everything that the Rebbe did, in every teaching that he shared, what always came across was the Rebbe's incredible Avos Yisrael, his deep and genuine love and concern for the Jewish people. And yet there was one item, one major item on the Rebbe's life goal list that he didn't get to check off during his physical lifetime. Indeed, on the 28th of Nisan in the year 1991, 5751, the Rebbe gave this monumental talk in which he stated that he's leaving this one item for us. I'm sure you've heard this quote often. I'm sure you've heard from Rabbi Wolf. I have done whatever I can to try to bring Mashiach. I'm now giving this matter over to you. Please do what you can to make it a reality. Be stubborn and be persistent, but don't give up the quest. He left it in our hands to check off this final item that has been on the list of Jewish giants of history for thousands of years of exile. The Rebbe in his years of Nesias performed many miracles before all of our eyes, many prophecies before our very eyes. And he's asking us to join with him in the greatest miracle of all times. It's as if Moshe Rabbeinu came and took his staff that he performed all the miracles and said, here, now you do the final miracle. The Rebbe is sharing that with us and encouraging us. Take the gold that you've been invested with and bring the gold, bring Mashiach, and make it happen. Make it a reality. It's something each and every single one of us can do. And because we can, we have no excuse. We must. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Rabbi Brisky, for making the long trip down from Agoura. And this was tonight was really, really special. I want to remind everyone that every Monday night there's a class over here at 8 o'clock. Next week we're going to have a class on exploring the seven unique Shiva Saminim, the seven spiritual qualities. Next week is Tu B'Shvat, so we're going to have a class on the seven qualities of our soul, which represent the Shiva Saminim. So come please join us, 8 o'clock. Every Mondays at 8:00, there's a class called Parsha in My Life. And it's going to be really great. And thank you again, Rabbi Brisky. Those words were so powerful and so meaningful. Let's make it happen. Let's bring Mashiach tonight. Thank you. Everyone have a good night and a good Shabbos.
Okay.